Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Malice in the Mitten. I am your host, Tracy Preston, along with my bestie, Christine. Hey, Christine.
Hi. Hey, everybody. How's it going? Hey, Trace.
Today, we are going to talk about a serial slasher, and his name is Elias Albulazam. Here we go. We're going to get into it. So Elias Albulazam was born in Ramlah, Israel, on August 29th, 1976. He was born to an affluent Christian family. His father had died when he was a child, and when his mother remarried, they moved to the United States. According to Wikipedia, Elias obtained a green card but never gained his citizenship. Elias and his family ended up moving back to Ramlah after spending a handful of years in the United States. Some acquaintances of Elias's in Ramlah said at times he used drugs and got into some pretty crazy fights. And it was after one of his crazy fights, which was extremely violent, and for one reason or another, Elias quickly returned back to the United States.
Okay, Trace, WTF. I thought we were talking about crap that happened in the Mitten, meaning Michigan. So why are we talking about this guy from Israel?
I'm going to get there, okay? So we're going to... Okay. You just gotta pause, because I promise, as the name states, it's all Malice in the Mitten. So someone may come here from somewhere, but what happened, happened here.
Oh, okay. All right. So we're just not talking about Michiganians. We're talking about anybody that travels to Michigan and starts some crap.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. I got it. All right. Some ground rules. That's good. Okay.
Yep. And not only for you, but for everybody else, because I'm sure they're going to be thinking the same thing. Okay.
All right. All right. So the key is the malice happens in the mitten. It doesn't matter where these people are from. All right. Got
that's,
it.
That's noted. Exactly right. That's all exactly right.
So what's this guy's deal? What's happening with him?
All right, so here we go. So once Elias was back in the United States, he ended up moving in with his uncle on Flint's east side. So here's a little nugget about Flint, Michigan. Per Wikipedia, Flint is located in Genesee County, and it is 66 miles northwest of Detroit. In a 2020 census, Flint had a population of 81,252 people, which makes Flint the 12th largest city in Michigan. And I gotta tell you, that's all news to me. I had no idea. Also, if you recall a handful of years ago that the city of Flint made national news due to the disgraceful water crisis, you know, where they had large amounts of lead and possibly Legionella bacteria tainted in the local water supply back in 2014 through 2019. And I wouldn't be surprised if that bullshit's still going on. Flint is ranked consistently one of the most violent cities in the United States going all the way back to the early 2000s. Again, something I did not know. Back in 2010, the number of homicides in Flint had already reached 66, but that number was about to grow, as this is when Elias's stabbing spree began. So let's get into the details of the serial slasher and how he earned his name. On May 24th, 2010, Dave Motley, a 31-year-old black male, was found stabbed to death on the side of the road. On June 21st, 2010, Emmanuel Dent, a 59-year-old black male, was found stabbed to death on the side of the road. On July 26th, 27th, 28th, and 29th of 2010, a black man was stabbed to death each of these days on the side of the road. On July 30th, Fred Kielders, a 60-year-old black man, also found stabbed to death. But unlike the others, he was in a parking lot. These men were not only jabbed in the way that you or I may think of a typical stabbing. The initial stab was always plunged straight into the abdomen, but then the knife was forced straight upward to the heart. Let's just think about the strength that it would take to do that, as well as just the sheer brutality of it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would depend on the size of all of them. But that's got to be some serious, that's like a severe, heavy-duty uppercut is what that is.
Yeah.
With all your might.
Yeah, at like a dead stop too, right? Because you're in, and then all that momentum is gone. So it's takes an incredible amount of strength.
Yeah.
So on August 2nd, 2010, at approximately 3 o'clock in the morning, a police officer on patrol saw something that looked like a pile of clothes on the side of the road. He didn't stop, But not long after he passed the clothes, quote unquote, he met up with a couple of other officers. And after he described what he had seen, they all went back to investigate what was on the side of the road. As officers approached the, quote, pile of clothes, they realized quickly that this wasn't what the officer had originally thought. What they found was a man curled up in a large pool of blood. To their surprise, the man was still alive, bleeding profusely and begging for help. While the other officer...
Wow, that's insane. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's insane. So we're thinking so far that he had the same type of stab, like a severe uppercut to the abdomen going straight into the inside of the rib cage, and he was still alive.
Yeah.
So the luck that that knife missed his abdominal aortic artery and the heart and the lungs and everything, this guy's still alive. Be impaled, and he can miss all those organs.
Yeah.
And that large aortic vessel. Do you know what I mean?
It's pretty amazing.
So he was still alive. He had to be in excruciating pain.
I just could not even begin to imagine. And who knows how long he was laying there, right? The guy passed him, then they come back. How long did all that take? And he's still alive and bleeding horribly.
All right, so go on. I need to find out what happens with this guy.
Okay. While the officers are waiting for the ambulance to arrive, they pulled out the man's wallet and saw his money was still there, which ruled out the motive of robbery. The man's ID was also in his wallet. His name was Arnold Miner. They estimated that Arnold was stabbed at approximately 2:30 a.m., and per Arnold's family, they said he was a kind man and they didn't have any enemies. Sadly, like the others, Arnold would never make it to the hospital alive. Police were able to obtain a surveillance video from a nearby party store around the time of the murder. On the video, they saw a dark SUV drive by in one direction and then saw the SUV come right back in the other direction. Over the recent months, Genesee police had seen a pattern of emerging black men being attacked while walking alone in the middle of the night. It was quickly becoming apparent that these murders were racially motivated. The investigators postulated that the perpetrator must be a very large and a very strong person, most likely to be a man. Now, let's think about this for 1 second. Can we please just take a minute to fully grasp this technique and the sheer brute strength it would take to stab someone deep in the abdomen, then without further momentum, be able to then drive the knife up through the diaphragm, through the connective tissue to the chest cavity? That's just insane. And that's exactly what you brought up when you were just asking me and talking about how...
I know.
Right? How much strength would that actually take to do that?
I know. That's what, I mean, when you were initially saying that about the other guys and how they were found, and then this guy, and then he survived. What I was just saying about how that knife or whatever he was impaling them with, I don't want to assume that it was a knife, but definitely this guy, even if he wasn't a big brute of a man, this person was definitely strong and definitely pissed off. But that kind of force, that kind of anger, like, that's kind of insane. And I'm kind of super sad right now that that guy didn't make it. Like, he survived the whole half an hour begging for help and took a half an hour for them to come help him, probably another half an hour to get him to the hospital. And then they had to call him deceased. I mean, I was really rooting for him for those couple of paragraphs that you were reading. I kind of feel bad for him right now, but okay, I'll hold on to that.
Okay. I know, me too. I felt the same way. I was like, yes, but then it was no. All right, so as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, Flint is a high crime area, and sadly, its residents are used to crime and murder. However, this wave of brutal, savage, and senseless attacks were something altogether different. It had a heck of a lot of people on edge.
Of course, in bad neighborhoods, we all kind of assume there's going to be, you know, some bad characters. But from the sounds of it, I mean, you had said that this guy wasn't a bad character. He wasn't out there hustling. He was just out there maybe going to get a snack or something at the bodega or whatever it may have been. But yeah, I mean...
Just walking
along.
These are
people that didn't put themselves in precarious situations, it doesn't seem. They just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, just going from point A to point B and then boom, there you go.
Yeah, that's insane.
Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, the community was putting a ton of pressure on the police to get this murderer off the streets. These stabbings occurred in different jurisdictions, which meant a handful of different agencies were involved. But these agencies were not effectively communicating with one another, which I don't really find that a big surprise. Out of this disorganization, a serial stabber task force was born and consisted of several different administrations. Sadly, at this point in the investigation, they didn't even have a single suspect. So this is what the police had to work with. They knew that the person was white because they had some profiling going on, very strong, and drove an SUV. A knife was used in the signature style stabbing, so there you go, it was a knife. All of the victims were thin, black men, and they were all attacked in the late night while walking along roadsides. In only a few months, the total number of victims was 14.
Yeah. Ugh, back to the preconceived notions that this is some white guy that's mentally unstable because he has some kind of racial motivation and he's picking on guys that are smaller than him at towns.
Yeah, definitely.
Because they're all thin black men. Mm-hmm. So it was like he literally preyed on the weak, like the coward that he is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, I don't like this guy at all.
Yeah, okay. And it gets worse. It definitely gets worse. So one of the victims, a 17-year-old, his name was Etuan Wilson. He was attacked and he survived the stabbing. Etuan had grown up in Detroit and was sent to Flint by his family in hopes of living in a safer environment. Not sure why they freaking chose Flint. Anyway, 2 days prior, on August 1st, 2010, Etuan was walking home at night when he saw a large man standing next to his SUV talking on the phone saying, quote,
"You got me lost, man. I can't find the road."
As Etuan was getting closer to the man next to his SUV, he was asked if he knew where a particular road was. As in most conversations that occur on the sidewalk, you know, people tend to move closer to one another. So Etuan moved in closer, gave the man directions, and once he was finished, the man he was talking to tried to stab him. Etuan was able to push his attacker away, but still ended up getting stabbed in his abdomen.
Oh my goodness. So seriously, like, this kid was able to, like, deflect it for 1 minute, so it probably wasn't as deep or as strong, but I guess this guy got cocky thinking, okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. Go ahead, keep going.
Okay. As Etuan was running away, he continued to look behind him to see if he was being chased. Well, he wasn't. The man just stood there facing him, next to his SUV, knife in hand, staring at him. Finally, Etuan came upon a house. He made his way to the front door where he began pounding on it and yelling for help. The woman that lived there called 911. I imagine that she was describing what the man looked like and all the blood she saw. She was instructed to do whatever it took to keep him awake until the medics arrived. The woman made a comment that it looked like the man was going to pass out, and they said, quote,
"Throw water in his face if you have to. Keep him awake."
Needless to say, Etuan was bleeding out. The last thing he remembered hearing was a man saying that he was, quote, stabbed in the lungs and they needed to hurry up. 2 days later, he woke up in the hospital to his surprise and to yours. Right? We got a survivor here.
Yeah, I'm super excited about that.
Yeah.
I love survivors.
He wasn't stabbed once like he thought. He was actually stabbed twice. So that's crazy. That's your adrenaline pumping, right? You didn't even feel it. Once in the right lung, he was stabbed. And like the other men, with a signature stab and slash that started in the abdomen all the way up to his sternum. His heart had just been missed by the blade. He required 40 staples. He ended up having multiple surgeries to repair the internal damage. It wasn't until 40 days later that he was able to give a clear description of his attacker to the task force. Etuan also worked with a sketch artist while in the hospital, and now finally, the police and the public had a face of the man who was terrorizing Flint. Not only do they have a face, but now they also know this man was approximately 6'5" tall and weighed approximately 280 pounds. He had a wide jaw and he was white. The profile that was developed seemed to fit.
That is insane. He is a big dude.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, it was speculated that these crimes were racially motivated, but there's this. Etuan said, quote,
"I don't know why he's stabbing black people. He didn't say anything racial when he stabbed me."
There were a couple of other victims that survived being stabbed as well, so hooray. And all of them gave the same description and details about the attacker. They all described that they were walking alone at night, a dark SUV would pull up, ask for directions, or a man would be pulled off on the side of the road, the hood of his SUV was up, and he would ask them if he could get help to fix a problem he was having with his truck. When they got close to the man, this is when they would get stabbed and left for dead.
This guy is just like all the other serial killers or rapists or like those pedophiles that like bait people. This is his version of, hey, kid, you want to go help me find a puppy? You know what I mean? That's crazy.
It is crazy.
And the fact that he's victimizing people that are trying to help him, that makes him even more of a sociopath in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Right. So like decent men just, you know, they didn't have a vehicle for whatever. They're walking. Maybe they need a soda. But and here they are. The man asks for help. And they're all willing to help him. Just shameful. So the task force at this point had set up a 24-hour tip line. They received a lot of tips, but nothing was panning out. 3 days had passed without an attack. And to the police, something just didn't feel right about that. This pattern is breaking. Why would this man have stopped now? Did he leave the area?
Or maybe because a few of them were starting to get away, maybe he just felt unsafe.
Could be.
I mean, as he should have, but yeah. I mean, if he had a couple of failed attempts, failure is going to make you start second guessing your process, you know, in anything that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he was starting to get paranoid, as he should have been, but he's a sociopath. But just because he's a sociopath doesn't mean he's not going to fall prey to paranoia, which actually is very prevalent in sociopathic brains, right?
Yeah.
So maybe his paranoia was getting the best of him. But let me not get ahead of us again. So, go ahead.
All right. So here we are. It is now August 8, 2010. The task force received a call from Leesburg, Virginia, a town which is 600 miles away. They were told that they had just had 3 attacks that seemed pretty similar to what had been happening in Flint. So, yeah, he packed it up and took off. A black man was walking at night when he came upon a dark SUV with the hood up. The driver of the SUV asked the man if he knew anything about cars and was hoping he could help him out. The man walked up to the vehicle, looking at the engine, and out of his peripheral vision, saw something that grabbed his attention. The man that asked for his help was swinging a hammer. So we've gone from a knife to now a hammer.
Maybe he was trying a different approach.
Yeah, like change it up because, ooh, I've done too much up there in Michigan with a knife. I'm going to switch it up a bit, right? See if I can.
Or maybe just his psychopathic brain was thinking, you know, I've had enough of that. Let me try something new and get some other kind of freaky joy out of it. Because, I mean, murder is obviously murder because they love the sensation of taking a life. But they probably also like the sensation of the blood, the feeling of it, the smell of it. Maybe he's thinking of changing up his act for a different experience.
Right.
God, okay.
Act two.
So let me not get ahead of us again. Go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. Luckily, the hammer that was in full swing just barely made contact as the man was able to move quickly because he saw it. And then he was able to run and get away. This incident marked the 3rd hammer attack in 3 days in Leesburg, which was very unusual. Luckily, none of these victims were killed. So he's not having much luck there. The shopping center where this occurred had just installed a video surveillance system which captured the vehicle. The vehicle was an older model Chevy Trailblazer SUV. It was dark green with a light tan color on the bottom. The hood also had a few dents in it. Now that they had the make and model identified, the police could finally put out a BOLO, which is be on the lookout, locally and nationally. This is when they contacted the Michigan State Police. The only difference between the stabbings in Flint and the hammer attacks in Leesburg was that the perpetrator traded his knife for a hammer. 2 days later in Toledo, Ohio, they had an attack that was also identical to what had happened in Flint and Leesburg. The difference here is that this attack happened during the day. A custodial worker stepped out of a building to take a smoke break. As he was standing outside, a large man in an SUV pulled up to ask for directions. As he approached the man, he was stabbed violently. At this point, the FBI had joined the task force to find this man and to stop these violent attacks. Remember that guy, Antoine Marshall, the one who was able to run away, pound on the door, and get some help, and woke up in the hospital? Well, he was the last of the stabbing victims that survived. Now that he was out of the hospital, he went to talk to the police yet again. This time, he was able to provide a more detailed description of his attacker. Antoine was able to clearly describe a t-shirt that his attacker was wearing. He specifically remembered the logo on the shirt had a specific type of gin on it. Also clarified that the attacker was not white or all white. He mentioned that the man had an olive tone to his skin. With these new details, a new BOLO was sent out across the country on August 10th. 2010.
Okay, I'm interested about the gin, so let's see what happens.
Okay.
Are we going to go more into the gin or what?
We're going to get there. All right, so with the new Bolo details out there, finally an extremely solid tip came in. A female called in and said she knew a guy who worked at King's Water Market in Beecher, which is a community in Genesee. She also mentioned that this man had just gone to Virginia the week prior to visit a relative. August 11, 2010, officers in the task force paid a visit to the market and spoke with manager Abdullah Farah. While speaking with Farah, the officers happened to notice some t-shirts for sale in the store with the very same gin logo that Etuan had described.
Okay, so at least we get to the gin logo because that was a little innocuous detail in there.
It was. So, it was. Okay, so when police showed Farah the sketch of the man they were looking for, Farah immediately recognized who it was. This man had worked there, but not for very long, maybe a month or so. However, no one knew his full name. They only knew his first name as Eli. Farrar also said that Eli owned a Chevy SUV, and it was the same color as the vehicle they were looking for. Farrar said, quote, he was a good guy. We never thought nothing about that guy.
Isn't that always the way, though? Isn't that always the way that everyone that knows the sociopathic killer in daylight hours or when they're not being a sociopathic killer, they always say how nice they were, how cordial they were, how friendly they were, how sociable they were. Isn't that always crazy how they adapt and chameleonize themselves in society?
Sure.
That is the freakiest part. Probably all of these sociopaths that we're going to be talking about is that when they're not being insane, they blend in.
Well, they have to.
The psyche of all that is what's never going to cease to amaze me.
Yeah, it blows my mind.
That's always going to be seriously interesting.
Yeah, I agree with you, right? Because they have to have so many personalities. Only this one can do this and that one can do that. And for me to continue my camouflage, I'm going to project this. But meanwhile, they're complete monsters.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so go on.
Okay, I'm going to go on. Farah then showed the officer security footage that had Eli in it as well as his vehicle that was parked outside in the parking lot, so that's a win. Farah also told police that Eli only worked at night and he was paid cash under the table. The owner also mentioned that Eli was a good worker, that he spoke with an accent, and that he kept to himself. The officers also spoke to another employee at the market, and from this employee, they were able to obtain a cell phone number. Yeah, jackpot. Armed with the surveillance...
Now they can start tracking him.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Armed with the surveillance video, a cell phone number, and an exact match of the vehicle, the task force just needed a last name. When the officers headed back to the task force headquarters, they briefed the team about their visit to the Kingswater Market. One of the officers on the task force said,
wait a minute! Did an alcohol enforcement sting at this very market a couple of weeks ago, and the guy in the footage is the guy that received a ticket because he was selling alcohol to minors.
Since they had given him a ticket, they had a copy of his driver's license. So now, armed with Eli's full name and cell number, as you said, Christine, they can finally track him.
They got him.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's see what happens. Okay. How long does it take them to get him? Okay. Let's hear more.
I'm going to tell you more. The task force also found out that while Eli was in Israel just before coming back to America, that he had also stabbed someone there. Remember that vicious fight I mentioned at the beginning of the story? Yeah. That one. Finally, police received a ping from Eli's phone. They had him within 1,000 yards of the Louisville, Kentucky International Airport. Apparently, Elias's uncle had purchased a $3,000 plane ticket, according to an article in News One. They couldn't risk him going back to Israel, as it would be almost impossible to get him back to the States to prosecute him. They had to make their move, and they had to make it fast. Police were able to confirm that Eli was on a passenger list, and he had checked in for the flight leaving that night for Tel Aviv, Israel. He had already boarded his flight in Louisville, but he would have a brief layover in Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport. This is where they put their sights on capturing him. They would have to stop him from boarding his connecting flight in Atlanta. That was their last and only hope. The task force in Michigan immediately contacted authorities in Atlanta. All the while, they were working feverishly to get an arrest warrant signed and provided to the authorities in Atlanta. August 11th, 2010, at 9:42 p.m., police finally obtained the signatures needed for the arrest warrant. Meanwhile, the task in Atlanta International were standing by. Undercover agents had Eli in their sights. They were seated in various different places in the boarding area where Eli was waiting to board his final flight to take him back to his homeland. Literally just moments before boarding was to begin, authorities came up with a plan to capture him and avoid any further violence. They had the gate agent call Eli up to the counter. As he approached the counter to speak with the gate agent, he was at last successfully arrested.
Well, that's exciting.
I know, weren't you on the edge of your seat with this guy? While in custody, search warrants were obtained for Elias's truck and residence. Not much was found, but because his luggage was never put on the plane in Louisville, they were able to get the luggage, and in his luggage, they found a pair of jeans, which had something on them that looked like blood. When tested, there was a DNA match to Arnold Miner, the first man Eli murdered in Flint.
Wow. So they tied him to somebody that wasn't even alive and could testify against them. They tied him to another person that was murdered. Like, I think that's really good. For the fact that they can connect him to more than just the people that did survive and could testify against him.
Yeah.
And that was really good.
Yeah. And like, did he not wash his clothes? I mean.
Well, apparently not that well.
No. Maybe he liked wearing the blood on his pants. Maybe it was some sick, twisted, who knows, remembrance of what he did. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. You never know.
Yeah.
Did they find anything else in there? In his luggage?
That was it.
Just a little bit of
blood. Little bit of blood. That was it.
And then it was probably an error and not psychotic kind of token thing.
Right, right. Maybe because when they say a little bit of blood, I'm like, really? Because it would have seemed like there would be a ton of blood from all of these stabbings. So maybe those were just the lucky pair of jeans and he didn't notice there was anything on them. In the summer of 2012, Eli was charged with the murder of Arnold Miner, and evidence from his other attacks were used against him. During Elias's trial, multiple surviving victims identified him as their attacker. In all, there was a total of 18 stabbings. Elias refused to admit that he committed these crimes, and his motives for committing the stabbings remained a mystery, so he kept his mouth shut. On June 25th, 2012, Elias Abulazam was found guilty on all 18 counts and received a sentence of life in prison in the state of Michigan. And as Michigan does not have the death penalty, he's going to sit there for quite some time. Now, according to Murderpedia, it only took the jury 2 hours and 23 minutes to find him guilty of first-degree murder. Elias is incarcerated currently at the Ionia Maximum Correctional Facility in Ionia, Michigan, inmate number 842658.
So he's just going to sit there and rot, and he's never said why. But he's still alive, and he's still sitting there incarcerated. That's what you said. He's currently still incarcerated. So if it was racially motivated, how is he making it this long in prison? But as I'm saying that out loud, I realize that there's, groups for all kinds of sociopaths. Mm-hmm. So he probably just hangs around the white Aryan type.
Who knows?
But he's not white either, so could he do that? Like, how is he surviving in prison? A racist pig.
I'm going to tell you how he's surviving, because he's a complete animal. So I didn't put it in the story, but there was a tidbit that I read that he was so violent that they actually removed him from the general population and put him in his own certain area, like solitary confinement. Like, that's just where you're going to be. So...
Oh,
yes.
So that's how he's surviving.
Yeah.
He's in isolation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if anybody wants to look up any of the links that I used for the story, they're going to see some pictures. This dude is huge. He is a monster. You can see him walking with the other officers. He's got black hair, dark olive skin. And this guy just looks like very, very scary and dangerous. Even if you didn't know what he did, just looking at this guy, like, hate is just coming out of him. He's just, he's a beast. So you don't know why. You don't know why he did it. What was the motivation? I just don't know.
He was just an evil, evil dude, apparently.
Yeah.
Just an evil dude.
Yeah. He really was.
Like, so he didn't say anything the whole time his trial was happening.
Not from what I saw.
He didn't really say much of anything at all?
Nope. He just sat there quietly.
Well, I did talk about before how I talked about how psychotic people tend to blend in. But one of his coworkers did say that he kind of kept to himself and he was kind of quiet. And I guess, in society, if a guy goes into work and goes home, like, nobody really bat an eye at that.
Right.
They let guys get away with not saying what's what.
Right. And with him being quiet and with him having an accent, it could have been pretty heavy. So, you know, maybe they're just doing the typical hi, you know, by the simple stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because he's so foreboding. I'm sure he just kept to himself, did what he had to do, got paid under the table, and off he went. And who knows, with him working at night, who knows what time he got out? Maybe that's when he committed these crimes. He was so irritated and angry with dealing with anybody that, hey, tonight's a good night. Night after night after night, because he didn't even work at this place for long, about a month.
Yeah. So what was the time span that this was all happening? If he didn't get arrested or put in jail until 2012?
Right, so the total amount
of... When did he start this?
2010.
Really? So in 2 years, he had attacked more than 18 people.
Right. Now, they're talking about the stabbings, but, right, so let's just add in, maybe that number also included the people he attacked with a hammer as well. But he started all this stabbing in May of 2010, like mid to the end of May. So May, June, July, August, and then off he went to Kentucky and started the hammering over there.
Yeah, and the thing is, the sad part about it is that there are probably other places with other victims that their murders were either went unsolved or blamed on someone else, which is even worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's horrible to think about.
Yeah.
But at least we know this guy didn't come back to the U.S. till about 2010, right?
Yeah, exactly. So he fled, right? So he went to Israel. He did the signature stabbing issue over there. And then he skedaddled on over back to the United States because he was probably about to get nabbed for this murder he committed over there.
Yeah, probably. And that probably wasn't the only one. That was just the only one that got tied to him.
Right. Because it was witnessed by a group of people, by his friends. Yeah, so who knows? Yeah. And over there, I'm not certain. I don't know a whole bunch about Israel, but and their justice system or legal system. They may have just killed him.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Who knows? Yeah. So that's the story of Mr. Elias Albulazam.
Well, this guy was a big beast and obviously a psychopath. So I certainly am glad that he's off the streets. But how old was he again?
He was born in 1976. So I'm 53.
Oh, so
he's 48. Years older than I am. Yeah. So, bad dude.
So, I'm about to do some girl math, but in 2012, that means that he was 36.
So, mid-30s?
Yeah, so he was 36 years old in 2012. So, he was 34 years old when he started, started murdering in the mitten. Mm-hmm. He was 34 years old. So, that's a good 14 years where he was probably doing some other crap.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because you figure he probably got big as a teenager and wherever his psychotic break happened. You talk to me about all this murder and mayhem. I just want to be like, what happened to them?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds like I'm trying to empathize with them too much, but I'm not. I'm just trying to understand, how does someone get to this place where they have such a lack of respect or for life in general? Like, to be able to take someone else's life, that's a hard thing to do when you have to, like when you're a soldier or whatever, and you have to do it, right? Like, that's part of war, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know that psychotic breaks that happen with soldiers that take lives or someone that takes a life unintentionally, like God forbid, but somebody that hits somebody else with a car and somebody dies, that person that made the accident happen, a normal person like has a hard time dealing with that in general, right?
Absolutely.
So take that knowledge about them not being able to deal with the fact that they took someone else's life, and then flip it on its head to people like this guy, where he's obviously enjoying it, going out after it, and intentfully taking a life. Like, how do we get there as humans? Like, how does the human psyche get there?
Right, and we're always thinking that way, right? Babies are not born evil. They're not, and that's where the nurture part comes in. Did something happen to you as a young man that somehow you flip it and you flop it, and then this is how you take it out?
If you believe in the nurture versus nature, there's got to be some of them that might be. I mean, we'll never truly honestly know. That's just going to be a debate that goes on forever, really. Nurture versus nature.
Right.
How did it happen? How do we get here? But what we can learn about, if people like this guy start talking and giving us their rationale, we may be able to figure out how to prevent it.
And I gotta tell you, I'm having some thoughts here about some future work because I'm in Michigan. These folks are incarcerated in Michigan. I'm thinking, I don't know if I'd ever want to go interview this dude. I
might be, really?
Think about it. All it takes is a few hours of driving one direction or another.
I mean, gratefully, they would definitely have some bars, bulletproof glass between you guys. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like, I don't know. You'd have to really contemplate how close you want to get to evil. Because this dude is definitely evil.
He is. But what about Christopher? I've been thinking about him.
I don't know. That would be like going to a haunted house and sleeping on the floors. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm all about the haunted, you know, ooh, spooky, spooky, until it gets real, real. You know what I mean? And this is like real, real. Like, this guy is, you know, I'm trying to choose my words here carefully, but what do you say? He's a psychopath, and he's definitely, most definitely evil, because he has no respect or regard for human life.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get to that place, at least, I guess I'm instilling my beliefs on this or whatever, which, you know, beliefs are only true to the beholder.
Right.
But I tend to think that he's got to be like super evil and there's something tied to him, you know, that like my spirituality, I believe in the whole spectrum and we got to have balance on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it goes to show me your friends, I'll show you your future. You get too close to somebody that's too far on the evil side of the spectrum, I don't know. It's kind of like cooties. I'm afraid someone's going to rub off. I don't know. I don't want it. I don't want it nowhere near me.
So do not go visit Elias L.B. Lazam. Stay away. Do not make the visit.
No. I mean, I don't like that idea at all. But I know you're crazy murder mayhem mind. You're super, super interested. I'm interested, but let somebody else record it and I can listen to it later.
There we go. Promise you will not go. Promise now.
I'm thinking it's kind of like if there's a hole in the ground, are you going to go right to the edge to look in the hole?
Probably.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think I'll climb up something high, get some binoculars and look in the hole. Do you know what I mean? I don't think I'd reach over the edge.
See, I would probably walk up to the edge. My butt would be puckering, but I would do a little peek over. Just curious.
I don't know. That's too close to evil for me. That's evil cooties. And I don't think there's a vaccine strong enough for that cootie shot.
Right.
I don't think there is. I don't want to mess with it. That's evil. Circle, circle, dot, dot. Nope. That's not strong enough for that kind of evil.
Take the holy water. Take the salts.
Yeah, no, too many evil cooties. I don't know enough, juju stuff to
right.
ward off that kind of evil.
Right.
I don't think there's a big enough evil-eyed bracelet to wear to be close to that evil. I don't know, but you know who you could interview?
Who?
You could interview the kid that survived. You could interview Etwan Marshall.
Yeah.
And see what he feels about it. See how he feels about it. You could look him up and interview him. That would be an interview that I would totally go for.
All right, but I'm not going to Flint because Flint's a scary place.
I'll go to Flint. I'm hood like that. I will go to Flint, no problem.
All right, I will go if you go.
Okay.
All right, and we'll have to video it.
All right, bookmark that for things to come.
Okay. Future travels. All right, well, guess what? That wraps up episode 3.
We're banging these suckers out now, huh?
Yeah, we're going for
it. I hope everybody's enjoying them. I think that we have some good conversations because we're the only two people that understand the complexities of our wackadoodleness.
Exactly. So listen, everybody, come back for some more wackadoodleness, and we will see you next Malice Monday. Bye.
Bye, guys.